Welcome to episode 10 of the Ikivi podcast. In this episode, we have with us Meera Ganapathy, founder of Soup, a writer and a children's book author. Soup is an independent publication bringing you insightful stories from contemporary India, with stories based on overlooked details and personal histories, amongst other things. We talk about how she started Soup, her inspiration with writing adult and children's stories, and the different forms of writing we can consume in today's world. We also discussed an intriguing thought piece she recently wrote about the pressures to love ourselves. All of this and more on today's episode that I hope you enjoy as much as I enjoyed chatting with Meera. Thank you so much, Meera, for joining us. I'm so excited to have this conversation with you. I think it's a conversation that needs to be had, especially with so much entertainment and media that's out there. Like, it's an interesting conversation. My first question to you is about Soup. Soup is a publication we absolutely love. The voice, the aesthetic, the people on it, it's just beautiful. And the writing is also both really diverse and unique. What inspired its inception and when did you start it?
So thank you so much. And I'm so glad you noticed that the writing is diverse. So the attempt is to, you know, get a lot of different kinds of writers. And somewhere, for some reason, by accident or otherwise, there are a lot of young writers who happen to contribute. So I started Soup. Now it's been, I think, four and a half. It's been 5 years, actually. It'll be 6 years next Feb. So I used to be in advertising. And I was there for about 9 years, and it was great fun in the beginning. But, you know, after a while, I think I started getting a bit restless because I wasn't really enjoying it. And advertising has a sort of hierarchy where you can do good work very occasionally, and everything is subjective, you know, your clients' whims and fancies and brand strategy and all of that. So what happened was, like, obviously, you know, I had to pay my rent, so I could never really quit. But after a point in time, I think after 9 years or so, I was in a comfortable enough position to say, okay, now I can probably quit and start something of my own. So the idea was just to start an independent publication, which tells stories which are not, you know, the regular, like, listicles and trying to get attention and be sensationalist and get. But I felt like there was a need for a quieter place on the internet where you can just take a breath and, you know, read and feel comforted. So all of the stories are sort of very intimate and personal and trying to reach out to that one particular need which the internet doesn't always provide. I think it tends to make you, it tends to fire you up or, you know, shock you or, like, draw you in a very, like, sort of clickbaity way. So I wanted to avoid all that, and that was the whole purpose behind it. Hence the name Soup. It's comforting and nourishing and that kind of thing.
Nice. I definitely want to get into how it's being received as well, but I'd like for you to tell us a little bit more about the kind of stories that you talk about. I know that you tell stories based on, you know, overlooked details, and personal histories, amongst other things. What has that experience been like for you, telling those stories and kind of delving into the untold, overlooked, neglected stories that have so much value and have so much emotion that's attached to it, that it's interesting that you connect with that as well? I'd love to hear more about what makes you, why is that important for you in storytelling?
So I don't know if it's something that happened consciously. I think it's just a personal taste, you know, like what do you like reading? You end up writing similarly, I think. And your personal taste sort of dictates the way in which you gravitate. So what really helped was working with like-minded people. So every time we work with, like, Sue constantly works with a different set of photographers or writers. And they all are on the same wavelength of, you know, looking in, like, not just talking about the big picture and what's like consumes people, but more of the like what's in the folds and the corners of things, you know, because that's what really makes the whole thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that was the attempt, basically, to look into certain things. And somehow, everyone we ended up working with on Soup also was that kind of a person. I think it kind of also is like how you make friends in a way. You know, you are drawn to similar kind of people. So even work-wise, I think the kind of readers and the collaborators who work with Soup are in the same zone. So they appreciate these things, and they also kind of add value in a similar way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's definitely a niche. I mean, of course, the clickbaity listicles sort of content is just what the internet shows you. People may want this kind of content, this kind of off the grid kind of content, but it's not there. It's not easily available. How have people received it, and how do you kind of get these stories out there?
Yeah, so it was very strange in the beginning. I was never really sure. I was sure of what to do, but I always got mixed reaction. Like, I remember a friend telling me, this is never going to work unless you put out stories every day.
Mm.
And every hour upon hour, you sort of get people to engage and do all those content wars sort of thing, like bombard people with stuff constantly. Somehow I'm like, I don't even have the energy to do this, A, and B, I don't feel it's productive, you know.
Mm.
But how it's like, the more time you take on something to create something or spend time writing it or making it, it's more liable to be a more thoughtful piece rather than a very superficial view of a topic. Like, how the deeper you delve into something, the more likelihood there is of it being a wholesome story.
Yeah.
So, it was very difficult in the beginning because we would do 4 stories a month. And again, since it's a self-funded publication, it's not like I had a big amount of capital to put in and say, okay, every other week I'm going to do a story. So we only published like 3 times a year.
Hmm.
And between those months is when we create the stories. And what happens is, I think, rather than a flighty audience which comes and goes, it's a leadership of loyal people,
you know,
who are expecting, okay, they don't mind that this is a sporadic thing. Like, sometimes there's a story and then for 3 months there's not really that much. It's totally okay because I think we value the
content.
Story. Yeah, exactly.
Mm.
So it has not been really like, oh, let me get more readership and audience. I don't think we've ever attempted to do that actively. It's more like how well can we convey this story or this message or this idea or this interview or essay. And the nicheness, which you said, is very distinct. Like, I know the kind of people who read are a certain kind of people, and I know they will value it better if it's told less sensationally, less
aggressively.
Less aggressively, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. What is your intention with the publication? Where do you see it going?
So, I mean, I would like it to reach a point where where somebody finds it and I can just chill. And then,
yeah.
But as of now, the intention is just to, you know, I really want to spend time thinking of better things to say, like more meaningful things to say. And until there's something good enough, I feel there's no requirement to get out there and really burst information or blast or some kind of, article. And there's no, I don't feel that urgency to just produce something. Rather, I wait, think, work with people who have similar ideas or who have something interesting to say, insightful to say. And I think it's not so much, a quick fix, rather than I'm thinking of it in the long term as an archive.
Hmm.
Something maybe right now it's only been 5 years. So I'm saying 10 years later, there will be such a lot of stories which will maybe like lend to a great print magazine eventually. Mm-hmm. So I see it progressing in a direction where it's more like an archive, whether it's in print or it's digital, but it's like a source of all of these meaningful, comforting, insightful stories that you can keep coming back to. They will be timeless because they have this certain value,
which yeah.
is emotional and sensitive rather than, quick and, yeah.
Yeah, I love the way that, you're thinking and the way you're approaching things, like in a very intentional and slow process, which yeah. has so I much
slow.
No, but it has so much value that in the world that we currently live in, everything is so like you're judged based on, how many visitors you have to the website. Like it's so fast and it's so intense.
Yes.
That it's very nice to be able to choose that that path.
I think, what really helps is that I'm not looking at it as a way of making money.
Hmm.
I'm looking at it in the long term. This is not a source of income or this is not a money-making venture. It's genuinely a passion project. So, which is why I don't feel the need to hurriedly create anything or grab eyeballs or do any of that, because I don't see it as this is going to fund my next few months. That's thankfully why it can remain what it is.
There's no pressure on it then at that point.
There was a bit of pressure in the beginning. I think I had attempted to also include a lot of brand conversation. Mm-hmm. Tried as much as possible to be very seamless and not, shout any sort of content out. And also try to tie up with people who were in a similar place, either it was this watch brand called Bangalore Watch Company, which mm-hmm. was all about reviving HMT era watches,
mm-hmm.
or Paperboat Juice, which also has a sort of sensitive and soft manner of speaking online, or a clothing brand which was inclusive for all body types. So there was some attempt to be similarly attached to like-minded people and also make money. But what I realized is, again, this is it's not a very, there's no way to escape that whole monetary and mercenary angle. And no matter what you wished or intend to do, it will somehow become about, okay, I need to do this so that we can fund this. And, there might not be as much integrity left in the storytelling.
If yeah. it
becomes a, yeah.
Interesting.
Financial sort of
thing. Yeah, yeah. So going back a bit to, when you were a child and your childhood, what was your relationship like with books and writing as a medium of storytelling?
So we moved around a lot, and I had two older brothers who were pretty much like very much into sports and all of that. And my dad used to buy us a lot of these Russian, I don't know if we bought them or we just used to get them, these Russian fairy tales and stuff. So those were the first real books I read. And they really left an impression on me because they had stunning illustrations and a very different world from the one we know, Like it wasn't Grimm Brothers sort of fairy. It was really dark and weird and creepy and very fascinating. So I loved that. And I used to love reading, of course. And the more we moved, it was more like you keep changing your friend circle and you keep meeting new people, and they might be like-minded and they might be in front. I mean, when you're a kid, you don't really think of like-minded. It's just that you get along or you don't.
Yeah.
But this is a constant that you can always have the comfort of reading a book no matter what. So I think I came to depend on books in that way. And I also tried to write a story when I was, I think, 6 or 5 years old, which really scarred my mother because it had a murder in it.
Oh, my God.
What is up with you? Are you okay or not? So that was the end of that.
Interesting start.
Yeah. Morbid start.
Yeah. And then after, your childhood days, did you continue to have a connect with writing and books and all of that? I mean, of course, you were in advertising, so there was that writing bit as well involved.
Yeah. As an adult, you mean? Like
when like a young adult.
As a young adult, I think I used to write horrible, horrible poems, which are very depressing and like forcefully depressing. And about things I had no idea about. Like I used to write about prostitution and stuff. I had never, no clue, never seen, nothing, no connection. So a little pretentious. And I used to also read like stuff like Byron. Weird sort of reading. But I think as a copywriter, writing is a very different process because you're writing in a way that's like trying to, every sentence is trying to draw you in, you know. There's no wasted, there are no words are wasted, you know. The editing process is actually great in a way. I think it was helpful because you're not talking too much, no more than necessary. So it's a good way to train yourself. So I do think that advertising writing really helped me in that way. What I feel has changed now is it's not that every sentence has to be a punch and, you know, like get something out of you. It's more like drawing you in. I think that is the meaning.
Nice.
Yeah. So that was the only writing. I used to have a horrible blog also. Not a horrible blog. It was an okay blog. But everyone is blogging, remember, at that point. Mid-2000s, that was a thing. So 2011, 12, that those years. Yeah. So
do you still keep that going, the blog?
Didn't it from everyone. No one will ever know.
Yeah. So you also write children's books. You know, and the and within the world of children's books, like it's definitely kind of becoming more and more important. I think a lot more mothers, young mothers, are interested in the space and want to kind of showcase a larger variety of books that there is. What is it about children's stories that you connect with, and is there something you like to focus on when you're writing children's books?
I actually really enjoy writing children's books. I think that's the most enjoyable thing that I've had the good fortune to come across in the past few years. So I do feel like a lot of mothers are, and parents, I would say, are engaged in their children's reading in a much more active and thoughtful manner. Because there's a focus on Indian or India-based reading and creating a world that's more inclusive to an Indian child. If you remember when we were kids, we read books which are so far removed from our own reality. Like even if it was as basic as Sweet Valley High, there's no way your life is like.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you blonde or are you like, you know, wearing crop tops or meeting boys with blue eyes? So there's none of that. I think that whole thing is transitioning. Now there are more Indian books which are well written and more relevant to the Indian child. And about the kind of stuff that I want to write, I think I read I follow this Facebook page called Reading Raccoons. I don't know if you're on it. There's a Facebook page which is about people are obsessed with reading and the kind of books they read and information is exchanged. And one mother had put up this book, you know, which said, I'm very upset because I was just taking one of the books that my son had bought to read, which I had bought for my son. And the one sentence talks about the mother and the father kissing. And this is not acceptable. And what kind of ideas are you putting in this child's mind? And do you guys think or feel the same way? And then surprisingly, a whole lot of parents had written, so what? You know, this is how it is. I would like my child to understand passion and not passion exactly, but more like affection between mother and father. And they should see this because it does exist. Why do you have to pretend that it doesn't? So most of the comments were more like, you know, pushing towards a more liberal and more inclusive and less strict and idiotic way of writing children's books, where a child is gradually introduced to a world which you actually live in. So what I think is required desperately, rather than being preachy and moralistic in every story, I think there's a requirement to have stories which are more about painful conversations, which like, you know, dealing with death. Mm. Or say things like, oh, he's gone to a happy place, he's gone to a better place. I mean, children are not so stupid that they don't get it. So dealing with grief, dealing with divorce, dealing with even stuff like, you know, classism, which is so ingrained in our society that you may not even notice. A lot of books will have a child who is around this child's age, you know, who's reading the book, and there's a distinct difference in the economic, you know, there's
disparity.
A big disparity, and it's, I think, important to talk about those kind of things, like letting your cook sit on the sofa, you know, house help sit on the same, in the same place as you, not having different cups and glasses. All these things can be subtly introduced. So you don't have to be preachy about it, but you can make a difference in a very subtle and important way. Something that needs to be done, but it's very important not to be preachy, and that can't be the whole point of the book. It can be introduced subtly, I feel.
Yeah, because these things can be sensitive as well for children, like especially if it's like divorce and I don't know, all these things, like it can be delicate. So it's really difficult to communicate as well. But it's so important that children know that this is what reality is, instead of living in another world completely as well.
It's a challenge, you know, because there is, for some time back, I'd been commissioned to write about the life of Shakuntala Devi, the mathematician. And she had a very colorful and interesting life, where not only was she a math genius, now she had gotten married to this person, and according to all news reports and articles, he was gay, which she discovered. And interestingly, she didn't, you know, it didn't ruin her impression of homosexuality, or it didn't keep her scarred. Instead, she tried to understand, and she wrote a lot of books about it. Now, I feel this is something that should have been included in this children's book. Because why not, you know? So I tried, unfortunately the book never came out. But these are the kind of things I think are challenges for the writer.
Like, yeah.
You suddenly, so it becomes normal. It's not alien or strange, you know?
Yeah. But those are the stories that are so important to tell.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The challenge, like I said, is to not do it in a way that's like hammering, you know, point, you know.
That is a challenge, yeah.
Yeah.
So, books are a foundational resource, you know, and has been for us in so many ways. And they can really shape a child's mind in formative years, like we're chatting. But in the last couple of decades, there have been, you know, an influx of different forms of storytelling and entertainment, particularly video games, television, all of these things that have a high level of stimulation, which people are kind of gravitating towards.
Right.
When we were younger, we definitely had a very few options with either reading books or playing outside, and it was kind of just limited to that. How do you see this impacting children today, and how much do they and how much they actually read?
You know, I think this is something every generation grapples with. Like, we all think, oh, it's only this particular generation that is not reading, that's not going outside, that's not. So I don't completely agree with this, because when we were kids, actually, we did have video games. We had Mario and
true
stuff, and it was very addictive, and it was a challenge to you know, wean people off video games and actually go out and play. Not as much as now.
Correct.
But it was there. There was Cartoon Network, which just started being very conveniently to lure you, you know.
Right. Yeah.
So there were those things even then. It was just not as constantly present. Like now I know kids who are so, you know, they know exactly what to do with devices. It's almost like they're born with this ability to touch things and make things happen. And I've seen so many kids sitting when their parents are somewhere and they have these headphones on and they're staring fixedly at screens. That it used to alarm me a bit. And I'm like, this is what we also did, kind of. Maybe not so much, but we definitely did it too. And how do you get them back to books is something that can't be answered so easily. I think what happens is there are different ways of reading books. I think there was a struggle even with, as the internet came about, people, even in advertising, people would be like, nobody reads long copy anymore. And none of this is true, really, because we are not reading books, but we're reading so many articles online. We're constantly reading stuff, content, or, you know, information is being sourced and passed on at a really crazy rate. So we're reading much more than before. It's just that our forms of reading are different. So maybe mm-hmm. the challenge is to adapt that print medium, which is anyway not sustainable, to a different form of reading, to a different format of communicating. Like a story doesn't have to be told in this particular way. You can also have moving images and words. You can have, I know app is a very basic thing, but there are ways to integrate these stories better. And if you had to go back to an organic form of storytelling, the best thing is a bedtime story. Like, how do you get read them a story? It's still beautiful. It's still there. It still exists. I don't think that's a threat so much as you perceive it to be.
And I think, I mean, it also has to do with adults as well, and all of us having different forms of stimulation that we are also gravitating to. So I think it ultimately ends up with what your priorities are and what you feel is important for the child, I guess, at that point.
And also, we are so overstimulated. If you notice, there is a point where we come to I've had enough. I need a break. Like, you know, I don't know about you, but I take breaks from social media and Instagram every once a month for at least 2 days minimum.
Yeah, really.
I have a meditation app. So even technology has ways to adapt to sort of calm you down if it's getting overwhelming.
Yeah.
You know?
And I think it's also designed in such a way that if you do end up spending a certain amount of time on it, it will ultimately overwhelm you because it's something that you don't have control over.
Yeah.
And you're just kind of letting this app take over how you feel and how you think, and all of those things can be quite overwhelming.
And the last 2 years was sort of reprieve, but I don't think human beings have really taken to it as they should have. Nothing has changed, I feel. But in those 2 years, or in these 1.5 years, there has been a slowing down.
Yes.
You know, kids are not even going to school anymore. And there was a large time when a lot of people shifted from cities to smaller towns, and, you know, for whatever reasons, economic or just having more space and not being cooped up in your home. So something did shift, even if it's very small, but it was still a little bit of a shift.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even with going back a little bit with, you know, children's books and different ways of storytelling, I do notice, of course, that you use illustrations a fair amount. How has that changed in children's stories, you know, from what it used to be to now? Like, how has that changed?
You mean the illustrations in the story
itself? Yeah.
So there are so many beautiful things which are introducing folk art. You know, so earlier we had such things like Tinkle and Chandamama, Amar Chitrakatha. There's one way.
Yeah.
And then there were, of course, books from abroad, which were much more fascinating, and comic books. And it was always very diverse. But now what's interesting is that you see yourself. Like, there are more chances for a child to see someone who looks like him or her, rather than just people who are completely alien.
Yeah.
And you can't really truly relate to, and are become unfortunately aspirational.
Yeah.
So, like, even the book Uma versus Upma, there is, the girl is like a dark skinned girl, you know, or whatever other books, whatever Pratham does, and a lot of these books, they are Tulika. I feel that there is a sort of representation of diverse looking people, which is why you could possibly connect more with the protagonist.
Yeah.
In that sense, it's good. And also this reintroduction of folk art and people like Tara Books and those kind of publishers is a beautiful way of bringing back Indian storytelling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So with adults, going back to that a little bit and about, you know, how we have, again, different forms of downtime activities, different time, different types of recreational content that we want to consume, which is, of course, quicker and easier to kind of consume, whereas reading is a slower process. You kind of have to dedicate a certain amount of time. Like, how do you recommend people to schedule that time, you know, to carve out that time specifically for reading? And do you do that?
Very difficult, because even I struggle with it. There are phases where I'm reading a lot and really enjoying this book. And there are phases when I just cannot get into it. So I would say, you know, somehow the being online or being on social media has fueled a sort of pressure to read in some ways, where there are these 100 books a year, or, you know, like Goodreads lists, and there are lists and the recommendations, and there are book clubs online, and there are blog posts, and there are, you know, newsletters, and there's so much urging you to go here and go there. So I think what may help aid the process of reading is two things. One is make it personal. Like, of course, get recommendations if you want and find the perfect book from a person you trust or a site you trust. But there is some value in going to a bookstore and hunting for books which you may not even have heard of, but like actually finding them and physically being involved with the whole process of buying a book, reading it, feeling good about it, and also supporting some bookstores and stuff. And another, maybe not a popular opinion, but, you know, if you don't like a book, it's totally okay to abandon it. Like, try it for a bit. I'm sorry to all the authors who may have got interesting in chapter 5, but, you know, like, there's only so much time we have to read or to spend in an intimate activity like reading. So if it's not working for you, don't labor over it. Keep it aside and maybe go back to it when you're in a different frame of mind, or just leave it and start something else. And sometimes reading something else might fuel you to reading more. It's almost like an organic.
Correct.
And I read this, now I'm on a reading spree, I can read more. You know, that does happen sometimes. So I would say the removing the pressure aspect of it would be the topmost thing. If you're a very serious reader, then just remove. It's an activity that's pleasurable. It began with pleasure.
Yeah.
So why make it so like, oh, let me post about these 10 books I read. If it works for you, great. If it doesn't work for you, just avoid it, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's such a valuable tip, because sometimes that can do more harm than good. Like, you'll just stop reading altogether because it's not something that you're resonating with, or you're not enjoying it, not resonating necessarily. But yeah, that's such a good tip.
And there are so many people who recommend books which with such, you know, passion, and it just don't work for you, and it's fine. It's not a judgment on you or your taste. Maybe they were in a certain frame of mind and you're not in the same frame of mind, so it's totally fine.
Yeah, I think that people do enjoy like recommendations and things, because we do this on Ikibi as well. We kind of bring together all the books that we have read as a team and put it up as one of the posts, and it's one of the most engaging posts. I think people do end up saving it, or, you know, like, people want recommendations. In fact, I was looking at your profile to see if, because now I'm going to go, and I was looking for a book, I was like, let me see if she has any recommendation. Do you do that as well?
I used to do that, you know. I was actively recommending books month after month. Like, I thought, let me start a monthly recommendation thing. And then I only got very overwhelmed. Like, I've set myself this task of reading these many books, and it's more like a curse than an enjoyable activity, because I have to now finish it and share my opinion, and who even cares what my opinion is? I mean, maybe someone
people do.
But maybe, you know, not the right time to hate on a certain book, because I'm not in the right frame of mind. And it's, the minute it becomes a task is when I feel it loses its joy.
And yeah.
As long as it's pleasure, it's great.
Yeah.
And then you can passionately talk about it. That's different.
Yeah, not expect anything or...
Yeah, yeah. Setting yourself this goal is where it goes downhill, at least for me.
Yeah, yeah. True. So there's one story that you recently wrote about called "Don't Ask Me to Love Myself." And there's a very interesting line that says, "And being told to love yourself seems like a different kind of assault." Yeah. Do you ever feel that way with yourself or for your work? Because sometimes I definitely do. And the whole kind of story is one that I resonated with quite immediately, because, and I'm sure that a lot of people do as well. Yeah. We're constantly told that we have to like care for ourselves and love ourselves and we are beautiful the way we are and all of these things. And it almost feels, and it can feel as coercive as the pressure to sacrifice or hate ourselves.
Yeah.
What are your feelings with it?
So it's like a feminist, it's supposedly a feminist take to love yourself. Like, I like myself the way I am. I like this about me. I like that. It's all very easy to say, but you're conditioned with years of finding fault. And maybe you're not comfortable with certain aspects of who you are. And I think it's a way of growing. Like the kind of things you hated or disliked about yourself when you were young may actually become very different when you're older. Like when you're older, you do get comfortable and you are less concerned about what other people think of you. And it's a process of evolution. And forcing or, you know, challenging someone who says, "Oh God, I hate so-and-so thing about me," without the empathy of actually understanding what's going on with that person, not even like going deep enough to say, why are you hating this about yourself, or trying to care enough to break it down and just saying, no, you just love yourself without any, you know, it's almost foolish. Like, it's not helping. It's too shallow to help.
Yeah.
I think it takes years to grow out of all these cycles of self-loathing. It could be anything from us, imposter syndrome, which takes work to get out of, like you say about work, like I hate certain things, like what I wrote 10 years back is, I think, a lot of rubbish. What I wrote last month also may be rubbish to me next month. So that's, I think it's important to understand that it's a process of growing, which I also have to keep telling myself, which all of us have to tell ourselves. So we were all discussing this one day, actually, it was a soup conversation on a story on beauty and how body positivity has reached an almost aggressive peak. Like, I'm very happy that there are people who are comfortably sharing pictures where they look real, you know, and there are more inclusive campaigns and there are more inclusive clothing brands, and there's not just one kind of skinny tall model who's probably white sometimes, you know, you look nothing like, see, you go, so say you shop online and you look at this girl who's maybe 3-4 inches taller than you and a dress sits very differently on her than you. Okay.
Correct.
And you might be tempted to buy it, and when you actually get it, it looks like rubbish. So obviously you need to see people like yourself more and more, not just for consumerism and purchasing, but also because they are bombarded with these filters and all sorts of things. So there has to be a balance, you know, and it's great that there are people who are trying very hard to restore the balance. But at the same time, there's also a lot of corporate bullshit, you know, like brands which are saying, oh, we are very inclusive. And then they'll take three very conventional looking people who might be mildly overweight or like, you know, slightly bigger than others. Or, you know, then it's more like lip service than actual change.
Yeah.
So that is something that we have to be wary of.
Mm.
And recognize and catch and remember that this is not the norm and this is not self-love and this is not it's a more exhaustive process of working on yourself, you know?
Yeah.
And it takes years. It's just not because I saw some girl write, I love my curves, and then I'm like, oh yeah, I love my curves. No, of course not. It's silly to think that way.
Yeah. Yeah, and like you rightly said, it's been years of conditioning. I mean, so it's yeah. not like it's going to be, you know, one day overnight or whatever, you kind of forget it and you love yourself for who you are. It's not going to work like that. It's Absolutely. Going to just take a lot and more time and effort.
Right now is worse than before. Of course, there are body positivity models and there are people who are plus size models and girls who are not conscious of their bodies as much. And if you go on the beach, we were talking about Ashwin Beach and Mandir. There are so many people out there who are not like, oh, like earlier you would see more girls in those longer kind of swimsuits. Now people are very open with their body a lot more than before. But at yeah. the same time, the act of even putting up a picture of yourself on Instagram stories is so fake because there is your face and then there's a filter which transforms your face into something completely unreal.
Yeah.
And then you are forced to think, oh God, is this something wrong with me? This is a better version of me. And
yeah.
this, do I have dark circles? Do I have pimples? Do I have whatever it is that you find wrong with you? These are constantly being thrown in your face. So while there is a good side of it, there's a 20 times worse side of it. So imagine being a 14-year-old or 13-year-old girl now.
Yeah.
You must be terrible.
Really yeah. terrible. I mean, yeah. you look at yourself in the mirror after you get back home and you're like, oh my God, what is this? Like, this has nothing to do. I mean, it doesn't look like anything that Instagram showed me.
Yeah, of course.
Imagine that trauma that they'll be going through when your mind is being formed and you're, you know, at that age, so impressionable at that age.
Yeah, because I think earlier we had people like Kajol who was kind of normal looking in some way. She had
the unibrow.
And here and there were people who are kind of okay, not so scrawny or slim. Now I feel everyone looks the same. They have the same hairstyle or they have the same appearance or they've done the same surgeries or God knows what, but it's really freaky, you know?
Yeah.
So there is a great requirement for the movement of self-love, but I feel it has to be less consumerist and more
inward
and deep. Can't be just like one campaign and everything changes.
No. Yeah,
I like Earn Black Official, this clothing brand, you know, because when you go on the website, there's one the dress is shown on at least five kinds of girls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because there's no one body type.
Yeah,
no, so I think you can't hold somebody, you can hold a gun to someone's head and say, overnight, you're going to change all your thoughts and thinking and years of conditioning. It's not going to happen. It will be a very slow and gradual change. But as long as there is some kind of change and you're going in that direction, it's still a step forward rather than 20 steps backward, you know?
Yeah. Thank you so much, Meera. I have one last question for you. How is the rest of the year looking for you? Are there some exciting projects that we should keep an eye on? And also, where can people reach you or access your writing?
There is a book which is coming out next year, so I'm excited about that. There's an anthology in which a short story is getting published. So there's a lot of exciting publishing work to look forward to. Soup will resume next year. And until then, I have a newsletter, so whoever's interested can subscribe. You can find all the information on my Instagram account. And you can read everything there. I keep posting my writing there. So, yeah.
Nice.
What I'm trying to do is like sort of put out poems and short stories every month, twice a month. And I'm only going to do this till I think it's a four-month-long thing. So 1 month is done and there are 3 months to go. So this is the second month. So whoever wants to subscribe, I'm on Substack. And yeah.
If you enjoyed this conversation, don't forget to subscribe to the Ikivi podcast, a space for discussion on living meaningful and fuller lives each day. The Ikivi podcast is a property edited and produced by the team at Ikivi.